sentence were fused with and interpreted in the light of a third, the urge to worship, to justify the ways of God to man, to explain the universe by means of a coherent theology. Quote, "Lo, the poor Indian whose untutored mind clothes him in front, but leaves him bare behind." End of quote. But actually, it is we, the rich and highly educated whites, who have left ourselves bare behind. We cover our anterior nakedness with some philosophy, Christian, Marxian, Freudophysicalist, but abaft we remain uncovered, at the mercy of all the winds of circumstance. The poor Indian, on the other hand, has had the wit to protect his rear by supplementing the fig leaf of a theology with the breech clout of transcendental experience. I am not so foolish as to equate what happens under the influence of mescaline or of any other drug, prepared or in the future preparable, with the realization of the end and ultimate purpose of human life, enlightenment, the beatific vision. All I am suggesting is that the mescaline experience is what Catholic theologians call a gratuitous grace, not necessary to salvation, but potentially helpful, and to be accepted thankfully if made available. To be shaken out of the ruts of ordinary perception, to be shown for a few timeless hours the outer and the inner world, not as they appear to an animal obsessed with survival, or to a human being obsessed with words and notions, but as they are apprehended directly and unconditionally by mind at large. This is an experience of inestimable value to everyone, and especially to the intellectual. For the intellectual is by definition the man for whom, in Goethe's phrase, the word is essentially fruitful. He is the man who feels that what we perceive by the eye is foreign to us as such, and need not impress us deeply. And yet, though himself an intellectual and one of the supreme masters of language, Goethe did not always agree with his own evaluation of the word. "We talk," he wrote in middle life, "far too much. We should talk less and draw more. I personally should like to renounce speech altogether, and like organic nature, communicate everything I have to say in sketches. That fig tree, this little snake, the cocoon on my windowsill quietly awaiting its future, all these are momentous signatures." A person able to decipher their meaning properly would soon be able to dispense with the written or the spoken word altogether. The more I think of it, there is something futile, mediocre, even, I am tempted to say, foppish about speech. By contrast, how the gravity of nature and her silence startle you when you stand face to face with her, undistracted, before a barren ridge or in the desolation of the ancient hills. End of quote. We can never dispense with language and the other symbol systems, for it is by means of them, and only by their means, that we have raised ourselves above the brutes to the level of human beings. But we can easily become the victims as well as the beneficiaries of these systems. We must learn how to handle words effectively, but at the same time we must preserve and, if necessary, intensify our ability to look at the world directly and not through that half-opaque medium of concepts which distorts every given fact into the all-too-familiar likeness of some generic label or explanatory abstraction. Literary or scientific, liberal or specialist, all our education is predominantly verbal and therefore fails to accomplish what it is supposed to do. Instead of transforming children into fully developed adults, it turns out students of the natural sciences who are completely unaware of nature as the primary fact of experience. It inflicts upon the world students of the humanities who know nothing of humanity, their own or anyone else's. Gestalt psychologists such as Samuel Renshaw have devised methods for widening the range and increasing the acuity of human perceptions. But do our educators apply them? The answer is no. Teachers in every field of psychophysical skill, from seeing to tennis, from tightrope walking to prayer, have discovered by trial and error the conditions of optimum functioning within their special fields. But have any of the great foundations financed a project for coordinating these empirical findings into a general theory and practice of heightened creativeness? Again, so far as I am aware, the answer is no. All sorts of cultists and queer fish teach all kinds of techniques for achieving health, contentment, peace of mind, and for many of their hearers, many of these techniques are demonstrably effective. But do we see respectable psychologists, philosophers, and clergymen boldly descending into those odd and sometimes malodorous wells, at the bottom of which poor truth is so often condemned to sit? Yet once more the answer is no. And now look at the history of mescaline research. 70 years ago, men of first-rate ability described the transcendental experiences which come to those who, in good health, under proper conditions, and in the right spirit, take the drug. How many philosophers, how many theologians, how many professional educators have had the curiosity to open this door in the wall? The answer, for all practical purposes, is none. In a world where education is predominantly verbal, highly educated people find it all but impossible to pay serious attention to anything but words and notions. There is always money for, there are always doctorates in, the learned foolery of research into what for scholars is the all-important problem. Who influenced whom to say what when? Even in this age of technology, the verbal humanities are honored. The nonverbal humanities, the arts of being directly aware of the given facts of our existence, are almost completely ignored. A catalog, a bibliography, a definitive edition of a third-rate versifier's ipsissima verba, a stupendous index to end all indexes, any genuinely Alexandrian project is sure of approval and financial support. But when it comes to finding out how you and I, our children and grandchildren, may become more perceptive, more intensely aware of inward and outward reality, more open to the spirit, less apt by psychological malpractices to make ourselves physically ill, and more capable of controlling our own autonomic nervous system, when it comes to any form of nonverbal education more fundamental and more likely to be of some practical use than Swedish drill, no really respectable persons in any really respectable university or church will do anything about it. Verbalists are suspicious of the nonverbal. Rationalists fear the given non-rational fact. Intellectuals feel that what we perceive by the eye or in any other way is foreign to us as such and need not impress us deeply. Besides, this matter of education in the nonverbal humanities will not fit into any of the established pigeonholes. It is not religion, not neurology, not gymnastics, not morality or civics, not even experimental psychology. This being so, the subject is, for academic and ecclesiastical purposes, non-existent, and may safely be ignored altogether, or left with a patronizing smile to those whom the Pharisees of verbal orthodoxy call cranks, quacks, charlatans, and unqualified amateurs. I have always found, Blake wrote rather bitterly, that angels have the vanity to speak of themselves as the only wise. This they do with a confident insolence sprouting from systematic reasoning. Systematic reasoning is something we could not, as a species or as individuals, possibly do without. But neither, if we are to remain sane, can we possibly do without direct perception. The more unsystematic, the better, of the inner and outer worlds into which we have been born. This given reality is an infinite which passes all understanding, and yet admits of being directly and in some sort totally apprehended. It is a transcendence belonging to another order than the human, and yet it may be present to us as a felt immanence, an experienced participation. To be enlightened is to be aware, always, of total reality in its immanent otherness, to be aware of it, and yet to remain in a condition to survive as an animal, to think and feel as a human being, to resort, whenever expedient, to systematic reasoning. Our goal is to discover that we have always been where we ought to be. Unhappily, we make the task exceedingly difficult for ourselves. Meanwhile, however, there are gratuitous graces in the form of partial and fleeting realizations. Under a more realistic, a less exclusively verbal system of education than ours, every angel, in Blake's sense of that word, would be permitted as a sabbatical treat, would be urged and even, if necessary, compelled to take an occasional trip through some chemical door in the wall into the world of transcendental experience. If it terrified him, it would be unfortunate, but probably salutary. If it brought him a brief but timeless illumination, so much the better. In either case, the angel might lose a little of the confident insolence sprouting from systematic reasoning and the consciousness of having read all the books. Near the end of his life, Aquinas experienced infused contemplation. Thereafter, he refused to go back to work on his unfinished book. Compared with this, everything he had read and argued about and written, Aristotle and the sentences, the questions, the propositions, the majestic summas, was no better than chaff or straw. For most intellectuals, such a sit-down strike would be inadvisable, even morally wrong. But the angelic doctor had done more systematic reasoning than any 12 ordinary angels, and was already ripe for death. He had earned the right, in those last months of his mortality, to turn away from merely symbolic straw and chaff to the bread of actual and substantial fact. For angels of a lower order and with better prospects of longevity, there must be a return to the straw. But the man who comes back through the door in the wall will never be quite the same as the man who went out. He will be wiser, but less cocksure, happier, but less self-satisfied, humbler in acknowledging his ignorance, yet better equipped to understand the relationship of words to things, of systematic reasoning to the unfathomable mystery which it tries forever vainly to comprehend.
Production copyright 1998. All rights reserved. For a free audio editions catalog offering thousands of audiobooks from all major publishers, call toll-free 1-800-231-4261.